Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now in depth on the power of protests.
Black lives may matter here!
Black lives may matter here!
Put your hands where I can see them.
You guys are criminals! Go get your money somewhere else!
Yeah, you!
A sound of protests from the streets of our biggest cities to the plains of North Dakota to small towns like Ferguson, Missouri, to the sidewalk of the Minnesota governor's mansion. Americans have marched and shouted and camped and clashed and called for change. Today, there are protests on the anniversary of Jamar Clark's death here in Minnesota, and this is a day of action for protesters at the Dakota Access Pipeline. Indeed, this is a country that was founded on protest. Think of what we learn as school kids about the Boston Tea Party. Remember that this country has sometimes only confronted change because of protests. Sociologist David Meyer writes in the introduction to his book, "Protests and social movements have become essential features of contemporary American life." But to what end? Are today's demonstrations producing significant change, or are they an important but not as consequential way to vent our displeasure and attract attention? And that's what we're considering today, and I'd like to hear your ideas about this. If you've been part of a protest in the last couple of years, what was your experience like, and what kind of results did you expect to get from the protest? And for everyone, do you think today's methods of protest, shutting down a highway, stopping construction on a pipeline, staging large marches, are necessary to effect the kind of change we need? So if you've been part of a protest, I'd like to hear about your experience and your expectations. For all of us, do these protests and the methods that are used in these protests, and we'll talk about some of those methods, are they necessary to effect the kind of change that we need? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Steph Curtis is at nprnews.org/live with a conversation there. Megan Ming Francis is with us. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Washington and author of Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. And she's with us from Seattle. Megan, a real pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much.
It's good to be here.
Amy Allison joins us. She's a senior vice president of Power PAC Plus and co-director of the Democracy in Color campaign and with us from New York City. Amy, I'm really glad you could join us, too. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
Megan, has it always been the case that when people don't think they can get what they want any other way, they turn to protest? And is there something for you different about the nature, the character of the protest that we're seeing today as with the tradition of protesting?
Great question here. In terms of the history of protest, in terms of what we actually think is different here, I think that there's a number of things that are different. I think people pursue protest in part because political institutions do not respond to their interests, right? And so my experience is specifically in thinking about protest around the Black lives, not necessarily in the current moment, but in thinking about it from the 1920s until now. Mm-hmm. And so my work around that, the NAACP's campaign against racial violence in the first quarter of the 20th century, African Americans took to streets in the South and also in the North, in part because they felt that political institutions abandoned them. And there was this need and a belief that that citizens on the ground could move institutions and that they could react, that institutions would respond to citizen mobilization. In terms of what's different, I mean, I can speak a lot more about this, but one of the things that I actually find really exciting about what's different from how we think about traditional civil rights and African-American protest is I feel like it seems to be different in the sense that more people from different walks of life are involved. It's not necessarily based in the church and in religious organizations in terms of the organizing, and it's not necessarily male-led, and I think that is really, really exciting.
Amy, do you feel like, I think it's notable what Megan just said about different people are being brought into the protest. Do you think that more Americans see protest as I suggested at the beginning, not just an important part of free expression, but as a real vehicle to change something?
Yeah, I completely agree. Hmm. Protests aren't counterculture anymore. They are an essential part of the democratic process. Think about this. The young people who are under 18 who walked out of high schools and middle schools and elementary schools from East Los Angeles do not have other political expression. They can't vote. And yet they're, you know, walking out with, you know, their way of saying that they do not accept the messages from the president-elect. They don't think it was a democratic process, and they're expressing what they can. They're doing what they can. And I think we can look at the protests that have happened in the last few days as a really, it's a protest itself is a spectacle. It's people gathering. But when you have 100,000 people, including students in, say, Los Angeles, it's an indication, we think of it as a tip of the spear, that there are a lot of other activities that happen that go along with the protest in the street. So for people who say, you know, that doesn't do anything, they have to, you know, we have to understand that because protest is part of how democracy works in our country now, there are people who are planning media strategies and political and policy strategies and other kinds of fights that aren't visible necessarily in the street. So what I see is a growing opposition movement, and protests are an important part of that.
Call here from Clara in Minneapolis. Hi, Clara. What's your experience been with this? Oh, shoot. To Ryan in Minneapolis. Maybe Clara will call back. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can. What's your experience been with this?
I live near and I participated in the 4th Precinct protest. I wasn't there at the initiation, but I went to check it out. And what I was disappointed with was, I really do think there's a very authentic, genuine, larger picture goal going on in these protests. There was a lot of people, like 200 people there for days. I forget how long it went for, but that's a lot of effort that we could put towards something, whether it's organization for smaller political parties or who do we want to vote for sheriff who matches these ideals. Mm-hmm. I had no one there with pamphlets, no one there with information. It was more like a barbecue party with a guy on a DJ mic playing hip hop and then 10 people on stage.
So Ryan, you were saying, hey, we've got all these activist interested people here, but we're not maximizing the moment with this protest.
I mean, well, because to act out a protest, we have to pay 40 hours each person, and each of those people could have put 40 hours of effort organizing clothes for food shelf going into winter, or could have been canvassing for the right kind of candidate in the upcoming election year. I just think there's a lot of free time that you have if you're protesting, and it's important to spend it.
Yes. So, Megan, I think this is interesting, the expectations around the kind of protests that people are participating in. What would you say?
I think that there's some really interesting points here that are raised. In terms of what this, of course, is a question about strategies of protest and what are appropriate and are useful strategies and methods, I think you said at the beginning of the program, in terms of protest, and also expectations for people that come and are also involved. I think that there's different ways. I think that there also is power to people coming together. Not necessarily in like a canvassing or a political way. Could of course different rallies be done differently and more productive? Sure. But I wonder also about the significance of getting people together, getting them out, making it so that protest isn't a drag and is at some level enjoyable for them. As kind of a step, I think that you have to oftentimes look at protest as a series of steps and stages. I think that once we go to a protest, a series of protests, we want to see change at the end of that. And I think it's a much, much longer process of individuals figuring out what proper strategies work in a particular situation.
Carl says on Twitter, I believe peaceful, in capital letters, protests are essential for social movements. However, once protesters are violent, I no longer believe it. And Amy, this is something I wanted to ask you because you said protests are not counterculture. How important is public opinion to the not just the effectiveness of the protest, but to the protest itself, how sustained it can be.
I think it's incredibly important. If we look back 2011 to the Occupy protest in a place like, Oakland, California, New York, or places that Occupy was happening, those movements had a large number of support from the outside community and helped to drive the narrative. The challenge is that the vulnerability of protests are when some people start smashing windows and other things, then some media will focus on that as opposed to the goal of the protest. And, you know, the caller who said, look, you know, are we wasting our time? The answer is absolutely no. Mm-hmm. We can take a page from what the Republicans did when Barack Obama was elected in 2008. It took a couple of years, but by 2010, they had staged a number of specific protests at district meetings of both Republican and Democratic, but mostly Republican congresspeople as they came back to their home districts. Those protests were not necessarily fully organized. They weren't, you know, they didn't have necessarily a clear message. They were an expression of anger. But you can see how over time, forming that kind of opposition eventually became the Tea Party, eventually backed particular kinds of candidates with particular philosophies to where we are today, where some of those same candidates who rose to prominence in 2010 are now positioned to be in the administration. So I'm just saying that as a lesson for how a protest that doesn't seem fully formed can actually, it's actually directly tied not only to voting, to opposition, but to political power.
Meg, Amy, you've brought up Occupy, and I wanted to talk about that. Megan, you remember that everyone marveled at how effective and sustained Occupy Wall Street was, where it first started. But there were also complaints, once they got into the days and days of it, that it was not organized, that there was no real leader, that they hadn't set out goals. Is that a miss for an organized protest like that, or is that the shape of some of these newer protests that we see?
I think that's always been the process of protest, of developing strong protest movements, is this moment of trying to figure things out, of this moment of confusion. I think great things emerge through these processes of confusion. In terms of it, specifically to address this question about the Occupy movement here, in terms of what was going on there, I don't think that we would have got a national discussion about income inequality without Occupy. I don't think we would have gotten Bernie Sanders or
That's
the millions
right.
of his supporters without Occupy. It raises this issue, and while it didn't solve everything around economic inequality and or kind of the abuses of Wall Street, it generated a conversation that then led to a more sustained movement. I think that's incredibly valuable.
Amy, yeah, I concur with that. Yeah,
I totally agree. Without Occupy, there would not be the street heat behind Bernie Sanders. And you can see how influential Bernie Sanders still continues to be. Not only did he have millions of people that voted for him in the primary, but now he has a role in the protest. He's endorsing the protest against the president-elect. He's involved in the pipeline protests. He's calling for changes within the Democratic Party. So the protest fuel has continued to take a politician with his set of values and given them more steam, more courage, and more license and agency to continue influencing our overall politics. And I think that's going to continue to be important. And I believe the opposition, you know, the people in the street, I hear people, people aren't doing anything, you can't sustain it. But I look at the growing support all over the country of an opposition movement where people are like, you know what, I just want to say that this is undemocratic, that we have an elected president who didn't win the popular vote, that we have a Bannon who's a white nationalist now. I don't want to normalize that. You know, I'm protesting that. General feelings that this is not democratic or not right. And I know over time that given our history, that can translate into political power, elected officials, and the like.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about the value and the meaning and the shape of contemporary protests, what they have in common, the protests that we're seeing today in our community, out of the Dakota Access Pipeline, in cities around the country after the election of Donald Trump. What they have in common with protests from, I think, the era that many of us are familiar with in the 60s, how they're different today, what their goals are, how they form, the long-lasting influence or not of today's protests. Amy Allison with us, a senior vice president of Power PAC Plus and co-director of the Democracy in Color campaign, and Megan Ming Francis with us, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Washington and author of Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. By the way, Wesley Lowery is going to join us a little later. He's a reporter for The Washington Post and the author of They Can't Kill Us All. He has covered a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests. I'm hearing from you this morning and some really good questions and comments here. If you've been part of a protest in the last couple of years, what was the experience like? What kinds of results did you expect to get? And then I want to talk about the methods. I mean, there are people that stand back and say, I'm with them until they shut down on highway. I'm with them until, you know, they're throwing rocks at police officers. What about the methods? How do you view the efficacy, the effectiveness of protests depending on the methods that they're using? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000. Shaley says on Twitter, I often find that the biggest critics of protests are the kind of moderates who put zero effort towards enacting change. They will wax poetic about what protesters should do from a place of comfort, not involving themselves at all. Steph off the page.
Vera says, please, no more freeway shutdowns. It's counterproductive. I proudly protested at the University of Minnesota last week, but I regretted it when the protesters closed the freeway. The tactic is dangerous and unfair, and it turns good-hearted people against the protesters and the cause.
Steph, I want to take that question right back to Amy and Megan. Amy, so you hear this. They're fine. I'm good with this until they shut down a highway. What's the value of that level of protest?
My thought would, there's no one organization that runs the protests, or controls it. So there are going to be different groups that you employ different tactics to interrupt business as usual. And I think that's the driving force. So some people are going to want to shut down a freeway. It tends to be the young, sort of the brave ones. But I would say the same, over history, the same criticisms of different tactics happen for protesters. And it's not for everyone, all the different tactics. I think that if people who are protesting can look for common ground, then that's the best thing. Because, public opinion, hey, it's inconvenient or I don't like to shut down. That's not for that particular protester. But that is a way for, it has been a tactic to get attention. Because a lot of institutions, including both universities, political parties, and others, when they see protests, and I know I experienced this personally at the Democratic National Convention a few months back, here's your space to protest within this little quadrant. We want to keep it in here.
All right.
Once they stay in there, they lose their teeth. And then now they don't have any power. So protesters want to, or some of them say, look, we're not going to go with the plan. We're going to get outside the box. And that's how they do it. Not everyone's going to agree, but that's where power lies in the democratic process for the protesters and the opposition movement.
Yeah, Megan, as somebody who has covered conventions and covered protests, I know what gets the media's attention. It's when you break outside of the box. Suddenly we're noticing, right? And I think that's necessary.
I completely agree. In terms of, we had a very highly publicized rally here with Bernie Sanders and the big disruption by Black Lives Matter activists of him that went viral at some level. And I know a number of the people who I'm friends with on social media cringed at this, and it also in terms of these highway shutdowns. But protest is never supposed to be convenient. Like, it's just not that the point, at least historically, is that it's supposed to go outside of the boundaries of how we think that people operate. In terms of, it's not supposed to allow you at some level. I mean, in terms of a number of the highway shutdowns, I've seen people on social media say that, they couldn't get their groceries in time. But it's supposed to disrupt the normal operation of politics and society to say that there's something bigger, that there's something more important, and to pay attention. And without these different types of disruptions, media doesn't pay attention, right? And so this is I feel like it's necessary to raise these issues. Also, I believe it's important, kind of this acknowledgement that change emerges through times of crisis. Change doesn't emerge necessarily when everybody is confined to a specific geographic area of protest, right? That it always, in terms of historical examples, protest often works the best when it violates conceptions and traditional notions of how we think that people should behave and operate.
Let me bring, this is a good place to bring Wesley in. Wesley Lowery is a reporter for the Washington Post and author of They Can't Kill Us All from New York City. Hey, Wesley, hi. Good to have you on the show.
How are you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I know you've covered a lot of that. You heard what Amy and Megan were saying about this. You've covered a lot of these protests. What would you say about your role as a reporter, but also as somebody who ended up being arrested trying to cover these protests, given what their thoughts are on this?
Of course. You know, I think it's really interesting. And I think very often we try to, those of us who aren't particularly inclined to be involved in protest, right? So people who are in the media, who like by our jobs would never go marching, or people who otherwise haven't been engaged politically, we bring with ourselves a very kind of reflexive skepticism. Like, why would you shut down my freeway? That isn't accomplishing anything. Why don't you people go vote? You know, we hear those things very often, right? But I think that often misunderstands or misrepresents the point of these demonstrations, right? People who take to the streets, whether that be after, you know, a police shooting, Jamar Clark or Michael Brown, or even right now, after the election of Donald Trump, we're seeing protests in dozens of cities, in Portland and in Chicago and New York. Many of them are doing that because they feel as if engaging in the political process otherwise has not worked for them. So the reason Portland is full of liberal Democrats protesting is, in fact, because most of those people probably did vote, and they're trying to repudiate, essentially, the decision made by everybody else.
But it's not everybody else, right, because of the popular vote. I think the protests are really calling fundamentals into view. I mean, you know, is this a democracy?
Certainly.
This is the first national election without protections of the Voting Rights Act. So in places like Ohio, people were removed from the voting rolls. So there's lots of stuff happening behind the scenes that I think fueled people's protests as well, to your point.
Yeah, Wesley, and one of the things that we talked about before you came on was Amy and Megan believe that the protests that led to the Tea Party have led to what we've seen today. Occupy led to Bernie Sanders. You know, the long tail that the influence of these protests can have. The other side of that is people saying, we just had an election. Donald Trump is saying this. We just had an election. What are these protesters trying to accomplish out here? I'm not stepping down. We're not overturning the election. What's the point?
But I haven't heard any protester calling for him to step down, right? I haven't heard.
Well, they're saying dump Trump. You know, so
sure. I mean, but that could mean any number. I mean, in the same way that people chanting "Take our country back" in 2010, right? What did that mean? Were they getting rid of the first black president? Well, no, they couldn't. He was still the president, right? The protests are not a direct means to an end; rather, they're a step in a political process, right? And so what we see in these cases is you're seeing massive gatherings in the street, which are literally, in some cases, networking opportunities. Different people with similar beliefs are finding each other in these spaces and are building alliances. They are having conversations. They are deciding how might we engage together. They're founding organizations, right? It's a capacity building exercise in part. And at the same time, it's also sending a direct message. It's a way of applying political power, right? If 1,000 people are standing outside of my office, I might do my job a little differently than if no one is standing outside of my office, right? It forces a different level, potentially, of accountability because it wields a physical threat that if you're angering us, if you're hurting us, if you're harming us, if you're not listening to us, we're shutting down the interstate today and no one's getting to work, right? Well, that is a means of people seizing back power from their government.
So Megan, I'd love you to speak to the accountability piece of that Wesley just brought up.
About protesters?
Yeah.
In terms of how they are responsible for what happens?
In terms of how, even if the immediate effect of the protest, that there isn't going to be an immediate change,
right,
that they're still, that they are a visible sign of accountability. I mean, do we have historical evidence to say, and that's true, that is how it works out?
Oh, yes, I'm plenty. And in terms of, that's also, I think in terms of, I think Wesley's analysis and description of the role of protest in the workings of a political system make the most sense to me. I think oftentimes when people get involved in protests, they expect for Occupy that the entire political system or economic system will be transformed.
Yeah.
But I think how oftentimes leaders, and at least what history teaches us about protest, is that it's a process. And that people, in terms of Wall Street, that wasn't necessarily to transform the whole workings of Wall Street. I think that is kind of an idealized further on goal. But I think in terms of, especially if we think about Occupy, to actually engage in a larger conversation about economic inequality. If we're talking about Black Lives Matter, at the end of the day, stop killing Black people, individuals and law enforcement officers. Of course, that all ultimately is the end goal. Kind of the shorter term goal that is incredibly important is to at least have this conversation that really hasn't been had about Black life, about the conduct of law enforcement officials, and about kind of the continuing role of race in our political system. Right. So I especially if we think about in the past week in terms of the election, I don't think necessarily, we all know Donald Trump, right? He's not going to step down next week. He's not going to step down next month. But I do think a lot of the protests that have taken place in surprising cities such as Portland to bigger cities such as New York do raise this issue and want to kind of create a conversation and are serving as kind of a road to wave their hands that we're here. You can't just roll out this agenda that we matter and we want to see a change.
Call here from Pat in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the topic. And I was at Standing Rock this past weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so impressed with how organized they were on making sure anyone that would participate in an action really took the class, understood that they were there to be prayerful, to be protesting but not violent, and agreeing to that. That being said, though, once you get into a confrontational situation, there are all sorts of dynamics that can change that, whether it's somebody acting out different than what they pledged, or just the level of confrontation that can happen when something looks almost military-like. But that being said, I think the whole change of consciousness is what people are striving for. How do you change the conversation? How do we honor the earth, and take in what the Native Americans are saying about, honor the water, honor the fact that we can do this different? And that was the sense of community was so powerful that it really was amazing to see several thousand people there caring more about taking better care of our environment.
Pat, I really appreciate the call and the benefit of your experience up there at Standing Rock. Wesley, I want to pick up on what he said about kind of the fragility of,
mm-hmm.
of the nonviolence of the protest. I know you've covered both.
Certainly. It is extremely fragile. I have a good friend of mine, Rembert Brown, who's a writer for New York Magazine. He wrote of Ferguson, actually from the night when I was arrested, which was one of the more violent nights in Ferguson. But he wrote that you don't know fear until you've stood in front of a row of riot officers and watched a teenager throw a water bottle at them.
Wow.
Right. This idea that at any one of these nights, or days, things can so quickly go from one direction to the other that something relatively innocuous can all of a sudden take things from being calm and peaceful to being frantic, that there's real risk. And I think that, what's been fascinating has been that, every organized demonstration I've been to has been called a call for peaceful protest. What's fascinating in the nights when things have turned more violent or been rough, or very often are much more organic protests. I think we're sometimes actually underserved even by how we describe this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's a protest. Everyone is a protester. And so in that bucket, you have the organization that calls a march for next week and they all show up with their signs. And you also have the people, the angry, traumatized people who see a dead child outside of their house and come outside and yell at the police. Those are also protesters, right? And so I think very very often we're underserved by the idea that everyone's a protester, everything's a protest, when in reality, you know, there are some nuances and delineations there.
Amy, would you speak to that?
Yeah, you know, I think we need to tell that story because there's an incredible amount of courage and risk for people who protest, particularly outside the box. And we saw 50 years ago with the civil rights movement, nonviolent protests upholds the community and the moral standards and for people. But it's always doesn't stay in that box. And, you know, think about the movement for Black Lives or Black Lives Matters protests. Think about 2+ years ago, what people were saying about those protests and the police response. What's interesting is you had, and both of the my fellow guests have talked about this, you have Black Lives Matter, young women speaking to presidential candidates, getting them to acknowledge the fact that there's racial injustice in America. And that was a consciousness changing to bring racial justice into the presidential conversation. And that those protests now, just on the election day, people focus on President-elect the fact that the Democrats lost the Senate and the Congress, but they're not looking down ballot. Those protests directly in 13 states resulted in a new prosecutor being elected that was much more responsive to community needs. And that's considered, you know, places like Tampa, places like Santa Fe, where you have prosecutors that are part of a criminal justice system who largely go unopposed, who were opposed by people who were saying that the system's not working. And so that is a political result of the protests. And some of those protests, early protests, did turn out to be either violent with, you know, people responding or dealing with police violence or and other things that actually have a significant real political impact in terms of who gets elected and who gets to call the shots.
Barbara says on Twitter, problem with protest fixes on negative. It accelerates frustration. It doesn't help dialogue. It creates polarization in current climate. Steph, off the page.
Jane says, I've never taken part in a protest that was even remotely accurately represented by the reporting of the action. I think the media plays a large role in not only recording the visual, but making certain they're recording the voices of the people hitting the streets. If the voices aren't heard, the action remains out of context for the viewer, and they can't make an accurate judgment about it.
To Kevin in Minneapolis. Hi, Kevin. Sounds like you've done some, you've had some experience with protesting, yes?
Yes, I've been involved in a few, some that have been organized, and ultimately what I really want to talk about is one of the outcomes of protests is a militarized police force. Mm-hmm. You see that in Standing Rock. They were given what most people would consider tanks, even though they're police vehicles of some sort, and those were given to North Dakota, and having Minneapolis police force going out there to do, I mean, there, you see lots of cases of harassment from the police and civil rights being violated, and it's not making news as much as it should, and you're seeing a highly militarized police force, and that's something that is an outcome of protests, even as peaceful as Standing Rock is.
Hey, Kevin, I think this is a really good point, and I want to put this to Megan and Wesley and Amy. Megan, I mean, sometimes the way the police react becomes part of the protest, but you see there's the tension of this, right? The protest seems to bring out, as Kevin suggests, more militarization of police forces, which is the opposite effect that the protesters would want to have, I would think.
Right, but I think that's an important point to pay attention to. I also just want to very quickly highlight there's a way that it's often in terms of the police militarization is often talked about as a reaction to different forms of mobilization and protest. Mm-hmm. But I want to think about it. I also want to think about police militarization as a response to some of the wars that we've been in, and as response to federal monies for this type of equipment. Right? I think that there's an important player that is not always addressed when we talk about the militarization of police. I think that there's a larger kind of area in terms of ideas about law enforcement and policing of different groups, different groups of color globally and domestically. And that has led to the funding of many local police departments in terms of tanks, in terms of battle gear, that we don't get the type of kind of combat equipment without a number of the wars that we've been in over the last decade.
It's a really good point. I guess, Megan, what I should have said is if they've got the gear, they pull it out. And that's, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
that's
then,
right. Yeah.
And then it escalates. Amy, you would say what to that?
I would say that you're basically bringing a point home, which is that often the focus is on the protesters at that moment. But we need to widen the lens and look at the context in which people who are trying to say something very basic, which is we are opposed to racism, we are opposed to sexism, we are opposed to, you know, we are opposed to someone who speaks against immigrants in this way. To broaden the lens and say, how are we being responded to and treated as people who are trying to exercise our democratic rights? And so I think that one of the things that's really important as we look at the developing opposition, I call it an opposition movement, not just a protest movement, but the developing opposition to the president-elect is to put it in that context. Part of the reason that movements develop their own media is because often mainstream media can report that story, you know, like the response to police violence kind of thing, where the story needs to be told. They need to tell their own stories and have their own networks, which is why social media is so important. So I just think we need to really understand the protests in that broader context.
Wesley, I need to get a news break in here. I'd love it if we can come back and you'll reflect on social media. We'll pick up on something that Amy just suggested. If you've just tuned into the conversation, we're talking about opposition movements. I think that's a phrase I should be using more often, and protests and reactions to social justice issues, racial issues. A lot of the protests that we have seen in our area, the Jamar Clark year anniversary, we're going to see protests today through and throughout the week. The Standing Rock, there are many people from our community that have gone up to Standing Rock. So we are considering the value, the accountability that comes from these protests, how important public opinion is to them, the long influence that some of these protests may or may not have. That's our conversation this morning. If you've participated in some of these protests I mentioned, it'd be great to hear you on the show. And if you're somebody that organizes through social media, I'm going to open a few phone lines for you. I'd like to hear about your experience with that. But a look at the latest news here with Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. The chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says the decision by the Army Corps of Engineers to delay an easement for the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline indicates protests against the project are succeeding. The Corps says it needs more study and tribal input before it can decide whether to allow the oil pipeline to cross under a Missouri River reservoir in North Dakota. The tribe says the pipeline would threaten drinking water and cultural sites. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker says he might be interested in being Donald Trump's Secretary of State, but a Trump official has told the Associated Press former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani has emerged as the favorite for that post. Corker on MSNBC said his camp has had some conversations with Trump officials. French President François Hollande says the Paris deal to fight climate change is irreversible, and he says the U.S. must respect the decision by the Obama administration to join the deal. Hollande said France will hold a respectful dialogue with President-elect Donald Trump on climate change, but also says he demands U.S. involvement on behalf of the more than 100 countries that have ratified the deal. During his campaign, Trump pledged to cancel the Paris Agreement. President Obama says the U.S. considers the NATO alliance a cornerstone of its security and that a U.S. commitment to NATO is unwavering. Obama, who arrived in Greece today, is trying to assure that country following the election of Donald Trump. During the campaign, Trump complained about NATO, saying the U.S. has been paying more than its fair share, and he will have to take a look at that alliance. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:45.
Amy Poehler, why do you think it's okay to read other people's journals and snoop through their stuff?
I know, it's terrible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joaquin Phoenix, and he stars.
And I'm sorry.
Amy Schumer, welcome to Fresh Air. Were you always comfortable talking about sex in front of a microphone?
I'm glad you asked that. Yeah.
My guest Jay-Z has been incredibly successful as a rapper. You know how a lot of hip-hop artists, when they're on stage, they kind of like grab their crotch?
Yeah, I have a great explanation for that.
Hey, if you can't always catch the conversations, and we have a lot of them through the week, you can find them on my podcast. What are people listening to right now? The Friday Roundtable, Who Are We After This Election? And my conversation with Carrie Egan, a hospice chaplain. on the stories that we tell about ourselves at the end of our lives right there. Search it, NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Back to the conversation now on protest. Megan Ming Francis with us from the University of Washington. Amy Allison, Senior VP at Power Pack Plus, and Wesley Lowry with us, the author of They Can't Kill Us All. So, Wesley, back to social media. How has it been an important influence in the way people organize today?
Of course, it's been remarkable. I think the point made earlier, it was a very wise one, about this idea of how very often people who take to the streets, who demonstrate, and grassroots political operatives, whether they be protesters or activists or just kind of local organizers, have long thought they've been misportrayed or underportrayed by the media. And so social media has been a very powerful tool, as we've seen in the last decade, in terms of telling their own stories. You think back to something like Hurricane Katrina, now a decade removed from, where at that point that was still pre-social media. It was before we really had the ability to see live images, to have people tell their own stories, to have people reach us directly. We still had the lens and the filter of the media, and that actually became a large conversation around Hurricane Katrina. We were describing people as refugees, and we were describing looting when people were trying to get milk because their towns had been flooded, right? And then you fast forward, as we see, whether it be, you know, issues like the Trayvon Martin, whether it be Michael Brown in Ferguson or Baltimore, Occupy, and what we see is people who have taken to the streets, and we also see this on the right as well with the Tea Party, telling their own stories via social media, doing their own journalism to an extent, live tweeting the protests, live tweeting the police movements, pushing back on when they don't like a headline, when they don't like the way something's being portrayed. Social media has empowered people more directly, and it's democratized news in a way that it had not been previously.
You know what I wonder about this, though, Amy, is whether social media also contributes to perhaps a lack of cohesiveness in the message of the protests, you know, in a way that it wouldn't have happened a few decades ago. And does that matter?
Well, I don't think, you know, we made the point earlier in the conversation about protests not having there's no single organization saying we're going to do X, Y, and Z.
There isn't an office of the protest, right.
And that's part of the power, because you can't just take out or arrest the leaders of, you know, and destroy the protests. And I think Occupy, the mode that the Occupy movement, where there was more than one organization and no discernible leader, that kind of way of protesting is becoming more important, I think, and more powerful and more sustainable, and leads to deeper systemic change. And I think the thing to remember here is that we're, you know, with social media, there are many stories being told, but there's a sense that you cannot ignore people's, you know, direct reporting of their experience, and having the language like the other panelist was saying, you know, having a different language to talk about what's happening. For example, you can look at people reacting to Bannon being the chief of staff of Trump, pointing to someone from Breitbart News. That is an indication, you know, people talking about Bannon shouldn't, I'm not going to normalize this. Someone who supports white nationalism should not be part of it. There's no one organization that's going to kind of take the lead and here give the talking points.
Right.
And yeah, so
and
I think
good.
Social. Yeah. So social media has become a way for people to use their own language, tell their own story. And it just reflects the multimodal sort of leaderless movements that are emerging as an important part of how the American democratic process is actually working.
Call here from Jesse in Forest Lake. Jesse, I sense that you might be a bit of a skeptic about this.
I am.
And I'm glad you called.
Things.
Good.
I'd like to say two things.
Sure.
First of all, on the militarization of police.
Yeah.
Say that three times. You know, I would think that you want to show up for your job and be prepared for what can go wrong and anticipate what can go wrong before it does.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they show up mobilized or something, I mean, you could argue, of course, as they seem to do, that things escalated because the police showed up with this presence.
Yeah.
But then again, you don't know when someone's going to start throwing rocks off an overpass or upturning cop cars or when it is going to escalate. So I would think they would want to be prepared.
And
but
your other point.
As far as Yeah, and my other point is that I don't know about everybody, but me personally, I'm totally numb to them. As a matter of fact, I see it as a, oh, great, another protest. You know, you take your family to the state fair, you want to go home on the freeway during rush hour, or you want to fly it to the airport on Christmas, and it's shut down. When they pick and choose to have these protests, I think it makes people less compassionate, almost bitter about it. And it just seems like it diminishes their cause. As a matter of fact, someone that may turn a bright eye and say, hey, this guy's got something to say, you know, I think it closes the dialogue and you don't even want to hear it. It just seems like it defeats its own purpose.
Megan, I think this is an interesting observation. What would you say?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. To the first question here about militarization of police, I do want to raise this question about in terms of what does it mean to actually be prepared? Right. I've spoken to a number of police officers, like I know many of the people on this panel have. One individual from the Seattle Police Department, I think this is also very revealing. He served on the force for 20 years. At the time, he always carried a gun. He said that he, in his 20 years, had never pulled it. That he had used his baton before, but that he never ever felt that it was necessary. Now, in terms of preparation, I can't likely be convinced that tanks and military grade gear that we use in Afghanistan is ever necessary on the domestic front. So I just want to just kind of
yeah.
in terms of I think you can be prepared in different ways, but there's not a blanket notion of what does preparedness look like.
Can I ask you to speak to that other point because we're a little short on time?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
In terms of now I lost that other point.
You know, can I just jump in and talk about
Amy?
The,
you can go ahead.
Yeah. The numbness to protests. It speaks to an issue that we're dealing with as people in this country. Is that there's a pressing lack of empathy, love, and sense of community, and I think has driven kind of you can explain the vote where people are not looking at ourselves as all connected as a people, but the lines between people are more stark. That person's over there, and I'm over here. So the whole numbness thing really speaks to a need for us to look at protests as part of our community saying something important that we need to listen to. And we may not be out there on the freeway, but we need to look at some of the fundamentals in our democracy and society and say, you know what, let me listen to that. Let's increase the sense of connection that we have with our fellow Americans. And that, I think, ultimately is a big message of the protests that I'm getting.
You know, Wesley, I wondered if you've written about not just the large collective protests, but the individual protests like Colin Kaepernick. Or what your thoughts are about that?
Of course. I mean, I think the individual protests themselves, again, there has to – a protest can kind of manifest itself in a lot of different ways, right? And what the purpose of any individual protest is often up for question, and often the person participating in it isn't doing it with a specific set of objectives, right? The Colin Kaepernick protest was initially immediately panned. Everyone said, what's wrong with
this
guy?
That's right,
And it's because he's not even a good player anymore. Get out of here. and then he sparks a massive national conversation. You see middle school students, high school students, college students, other professional athletes, this huge conversation about what it means to be an American, what patriotism means. Oh, and by the way, he gets a starting job back and ends up playing brilliantly, right? And so it speaks to this idea of, we never know what the power – this is the beauty of the First Amendment, right? We don't know what the power of my one word is to change the country or change the world. We don't know what the power of your one action is. Yeah. And so protests very often manifest that way. It's not a means to a specific end, but rather it is an individual act of democracy, and who knows where that will lead.
I wonder what you all thought of what Wesley Morris wrote about race and patriotism and protest in the Times. I've got just a little graph here that I thought I'd read. He says, new expressions of patriotism always make certain white people fear that a wedge is being driven between them and their America, whether by Muhammad Ali's refusal to be inducted into the army or by Black Lives Matter or by a backup quarterback for the 49ers. The fear is almost as old as the nation. Sometimes it feels as if the fear is the nation. Amy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking about just a mile from where I grew up, Pittsburgh, California, which is in the Bay Area. Someone, after Trump was elected, put up a big sign on the side of their house that said, "You can hang an N-word from a tree. Equal rights he'll never see." And I thought, that's that, you know, lynchings that happened after the Civil War concluded during Reconstruction, when black people were attempting to have rights as a citizens, that spiked in the 1930s, all the way till now. That's a deep historical thread, and it's a direct threat to a whole community of people. And for someone to feel so emboldened to make that violent threat. And people say, "Oh, well, California voted for Clinton overwhelmingly." Yeah, that might be true. But there are people all over the country who are pulling back these historical threats, bringing them into the present. And that's making the sense of urgency for many people. That's driving people out into the street. How is this person feeling so confident and to make that statement? How is that legal all of a sudden? How is that okay? That cannot be normalized. That is not acceptable. And I think a lot of people are coming out into the streets because of it. They sense an urgency because of that.
Amy, Wesley, Megan, thank you so much for a really enlightening conversation. So glad you all were available to us today.
Thank you so much.
Great, thanks.
Call here. Last thought here from Mark in Minneapolis. And Mark, it sounds like this is something you talk to your students about.
Yes, I appreciate you taking the call here. I've been involved in protests with Jamar Clark, and I've been out to Standing Rock. And one of the things I talk to students at Bethel University about is that, I mean, protest goes back to biblical times as the idea of helping to balance power imbalances mm-hmm. with the oppressed, even going back to the Exodus, where God kind of leveraged power, creating disturbances, social disturbances to innocent people that, you know, they didn't want their traffic to be blocked. They didn't want flies in their water or whatever, you know. And got to a place that the justice had to be corrected. And so I think it's really a powerful tool. And it does create disturbance and uncomfortableness with people that maybe could say, "I don't have anything to do with this." But it gets to the point that the society as a greater whole has to act because of the oppression of the oppressed group.
Mark, just real briefly, I was curious about what your sense is about, where protests are on college campuses, because a lot of the protests that we've talked about this morning are not taking place on college campuses as they traditionally would.
I think that raises a huge issue. I think everything from where millennials are at with this, I mean, but also I think people feel, I know at some private colleges that a lot of times they struggle with knowing if their voice is going to be accepted and heard.
Right.
And at public colleges, I think they feel like there's more of an outlet off campus to step outside and do that. But I agree. It's definitely different than the 60s and what we have seen in the past.
Mark, really glad you heard the show and you called. Thanks much.
Thank you very much.
Bruce says research suggests for some people the act of protesting is more important than the issue. Gordon says protests after 2008 election successfully galvanized people to sweep later elections. Real quickly there, Steph.
Kyle says, "I prefer to be referred to as a protector, not a protester. I went out to Standing Rock in August with my daughter."
Opposition movement. I think that's a phrase that, as we continue to cover this, that you'll hear more often on this show. You can continue to tweet in if you've been to Standing Rock, if you've joined some of the protests, like to hear about your experience, @CarrieMPR.